Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm your host, Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crown Town, Charlotte, North Carolina. This week, I'm on the road in Somerville, Mass., just outside of Boston, and I'm sitting down with Rabbi Charlie Schwartz, one of the founders of Lehr House, or House of Learning, where Jewish food, cocktails, and learning converge. Charlie and his partner Josh are Jewish digital media pioneers, showing how their Lehr House model brings us a worthwhile third space in our lives. Oh, my day of rest old-fashioned is up. Let's get into it, y'all. Hey friends, welcome back to the lab. So this week I sat down with Rabbi Charlie Schwartz, co-founder and director of Lehr House, whose vision, with his partner Josh Fuhr, has proven to be a holistic endeavor. They have taken advantage of every aspect of the space and daily business to promote learning and growing. If you've listened to this show, we did an episode on the historic Lehr House in Frankfurt that was about 100 years ago. But in this place, every drink, every dish, every piece of art on the wall, every book on the shelves, every classroom, and every person were teaching all the time in this space. It was amazing. Lehr House was something that left with you as you exited. It became new habits, new ideas, and a place people could return for a quick refuel anytime. Lehr House had emerged as a rising example of a successful third space in Jewish life, and Charlie really helps us see that. He has spent years at the intersection of Jewish learning, digital media, spaces, and building projects in physical communities that asked how Torah could show up in our ordinary daily life. In our conversation, which was on the patio at Lehr House, a little noisy, we explored how the passion that he had and Josh had turned into physical Lehr House, and what he and Josh believed was possible when a tavern became a house of learning and a laboratory for Jewish futures. Without further ado, friends, here's my interview with Rabbi Charlie Schwartz.
All right. So we're live here tonight at Lehr House in Somerville, Massachusetts, this Jewish tavern and house of learning that's reimagining what public Jewish space can be. And I'm here with Rabbi Charlie Schwartz, co-founder and director of Lehr House. He's a rabbi, an educator, and a community builder whose path runs from playing tuba at Oberlin and building kosher halal hospitality there, and serving as a squad commander in the IDF to pioneering creative digital projects for Jewish learning, like MediaMidrash.org, Pocket Torah, Aleph Bet, and Not a Box Media Lab, almost two decades ago now.
Yeah, we've been going for a while.
That's pretty damn impressive, my friend. I'm super happy to be chatting with you later this evening. I'm so grateful. Thank you for having me out. I'm going to be teaching a class right here at Lehr House, and I wanted to sit down with Charlie and hear about the whole journey, the music, the military service, the hospitality, his experiments in media, how it all came together in this amazing place called Lehr House.
So great to have you here, and looking forward to talking.
Fabulous. So I want to start, as we always do on the show, just kind of asking you about your origin story. Like, how did you become Rabbi Charlie?
I grew up in Portland, Oregon, which is, I think, an important part of the origin story. So I grew up in a house that was deeply Jewish and committed to Judaism, but in an environment that, you know, there aren't as many Jews in Oregon as there are in, let's say, New York or California. And so I was always very aware of my Jewishness and how it was something to treasure and something valuable and something that made me slightly different than my peers growing up. So I think that's an important frame. I always loved Judaism, and I loved being in a Jewish community and learning more about Judaism. And so that took me to, gap year in Israel, to studying Jewish studies and religion at Oberlin, and eventually pursuing, Jewish life and community professionally as a rabbi. But I think, like, you know, if I had to, what that moment of origin, was or is, was growing up in a house that just loved Jewish life.
That's amazing. that really helps, right, in kind of shaping. So you seem to understand the impact of the work we do in the community and what that really looks like. I'm curious too, because I've heard just some rumors through the rumor mill that you also are interested in like sci-fi and fantasy and some things like that, or you're furrowing your brow. So maybe I heard wrong.
Yeah,
I mean, you have some geek connections.
Yeah, I am wrong on that. I do play the tuba, so maybe that's what you're.
That threw me off.
Yeah, I mean, like, I got, you know, I appreciate good sci-fi. Like, you know, I definitely read a bunch of Orson Scott Card growing up, but I wouldn't say like, you know, when I encounter like real sci-fi heads, like that's not quite me. So yeah, I don't know where you're getting your information from, but it's like not 100% wrong, but I wouldn't say it was, it's 100% accurate.
Got it. Well, that's fair. That's why we asked, right?
Yeah.
What about Jewish mythology and mysticism and things like that? Yeah. Is that something that you find interest in?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think in the way, you know, Kabbalah and mysticism has kind of integrated itself into mainstream Judaism at this point. Like that's, you know, that's kind of where I'm at. Like, you know, I think hard about, you know, Lurianic Kabbalah and what it means to live in a world where our actions can have profound consequences and impact in the world, whether they're small or large, which I think, you know, is one of the key lessons of Lurianic Kabbalah. Am I a mystic? Probably not. Do I love a good mystical experience every once in a while? Yeah, I indulge. Yeah. So, nice. Yeah.
Very cool. But you're a dreamer of beyond, right? And you see, obviously, through your study in as a rabbi and in your studies now, that like, you know, there's an inherent futurism in Judaism.
Yeah. So what I would say is like less than, you know, than a mystical disposition, I would say that's more of a prophetic disposition.
Yeah.
It's like, what does it mean to see the world not as it is, but as it might be? And some, you know, if we look to, you know, the prophets in the Hebrew Bible, some of them see a more negative world, but a lot of them see a more positive world. And imagine, you know, if we behave in a certain way, if we act in a certain way, what is the type of world that together we can build? So yeah, so I'd say it's like, for me at least, it's less mystical and more prophetic.
Yeah, I read on the website that in the creation of this place, y'all very much researched Franz Rosenzweig, Jüdische Lehrhaus, right?
Yeah.
Talk about that. Like, just when did you encounter that, and how did it inspire you?
Yeah. So, you know, what you're referencing is, you know, in the 1920s, Franz Rosenzweig and Martin Buber, two pretty well-known Jewish philosophers, invented the idea of a Lehrhaus, of a house of learning in Frankfurt, Germany. And their main thesis was what the Jewish world needs right now is a return to Jewish learning, mm-hmm. and a return to Jewish learning in a certain and specific way. So not
and in the age of Zionism. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, Rosenzweig himself was not a super Zionist. Buber was. It was this kind of interesting meeting of like both Zionists and non-Zionists in a space. Mm-hmm. And it's which is like interesting to think about now, right? Like what are the spaces where that can happen? We like to think this is one of them, but yeah, it's the, you know, they were dealing with a lot of the same issues that we deal with of a fractured and divided community that feels alienated from its Jewish history, and asking the questions about how can we both bring the community together and how can we make people more connected to Jewish life in a vibrant, living way and not in a stale way. And so my co-founder Josh Warren and I looked at that as inspiration. I will say that Rosenzweig never had a bar. It was more of like right. a roving salon. So, you know, we
don't have a menu from the original.
Yeah,
house,
exactly. Right? Exactly. So, we have some of the class offerings.
Oh, nice.
But you know, we kind of imagine like, okay, so what does this idea of a gathering space for the Jewish community where the best of the Jewish world, where our ideas, our culture, our culinary traditions can come to the forefront and where gathering can really take place, what does that look like now for the 21st century in Somerville, like the heart of young Jewish Boston? Mm-hmm. And we thought like, okay, we could do a roving salon, but wouldn't it be more impactful if we did something that was, you know, really about putting Judaism and Jewish life in the public square in an accessible way. And like after a bunch of pretty bad ideas, we came up with this idea, okay, so what is like a Jewish tavern and house of learning look like in Somerville right now? And now, you know, 3 years in, we're here where we have 30,000 people a year coming through the door, 7,000 learners a year. And yeah, we're looking to expand because every city should have a Lehrhaus. Charlotte should have a Lair Hero.
Bezrat Hashem, we should, right? That's amazing. I mean, right. We don't know what kind of food. We know that food was central to the original Lair House, but we don't, you know, there wasn't like
a recipe. I don't think food was essential. So it was, it was a salon. It was like you would meet in people's living rooms and they had an office in a synagogue. And like, I don't know, maybe they had coffee and tea and maybe they smoked cigarettes, but like, maybe there was like, I don't know, maybe there was some strudel or something, but you don't, that's not, it wasn't the kind of, it wasn't part of the core experience. The core experience was learning, and the core experience here is also learning, but also through the lens of food and drink.
And I love that, right? I was going to ask you about food and things to come, but obviously I love the mural here by Chloe Rubenstein and of the hoopoe bird, right?
Yeah.
Hoopoe, right? Or hoopoe?
A hoopoe or a duchifat in Hebrew.
Right, which is a bird that does migrate to Israel, right, and through that region.
Yeah, so we chose the hoopoe for a couple of reasons. One, it's just an awesome looking bird. Like if you don't know like what it looks like, it's like it has an orange body and these black and white striped wings and basically
it's like
an orange, yeah, like a
right?
Mohawk. It's you know, it's just like a very very cool looking bird. It's a migratory bird that covers much of the Jewish diaspora. So it's the idea of like what it means to, you know, to move around. It's a national bird of Israel. And it's also a bird that has like both resonance in Jewish Midrashic tradition and also in Muslim tradition. So it's like there's like a both like a Sufi and a Jewish connection to the hoopoe. And I think in a way that like that's great because it grounds us in the land of Israel, but also migration, but also a reminder that like these symbols and these ideas like extend outwards as well. We playfully call this hoopoe Edgar, as in Edgar Allan Hoopoe. but yeah, it's kind of become a secondary emblem of Lair House here.
And I love that, right? Because it's like, you know, murals are a thing I'm into. So I was super excited when I saw this.
Yeah.
I'd love to meet Chloe, you know, expand
she's great.
Jewish mural world, street art world.
Yeah, she's great. Just to get very specific. So in Midrashic tradition, the hoopoe guards the shamir, which is the worm that mythically Solomon used to create the temple.
Right. And cut the
stone without any tools. And so the hoopoe is the guardian of the shamir, which is kind of interesting to think about. And then the Sufi tradition, if you know the story, the book Conference of the Birds, the hoopoe is the kind of guide for all the birds as they go on their journey to find the king of the birds. So
Interesting. Yeah. I love that. So a little animistic kind of connection as well.
Yeah.
You know, so there's an opportunity for learning here in art, right? There's an opportunity, obviously, in the classrooms here, right? But then food and cocktails is also a tremendous space to learn, which Franz didn't take advantage of.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So we like to say, like, you'd be hard put to set a foot into Lair House here and not learn something. Learning is integrated into every aspect of what we do here. So from, you know, we have about 3,000 books on the walls. It's like our main decorative element is books everywhere.
There's and great ones.
Holy texts and graphic novels, Talmuds and cookbooks, some sacred, some profane, you know, really the totality of Jewish experience. And our menu too tells us like wide range of Jewish experience. Our menus look like a page of Talmud with the hope that you will read the commentary on the outside to understand like what are the stories that we're telling. And it's not, you know, oftentimes when you go to like a quote unquote Jewish restaurant, it's oftentimes like some version of Israeli food or kind of deli food. And we try to expand the stories that we tell out kind of like a little bit farther. So, you know, we have dishes that reference the experience of Jews in India, in Iraq, in North Africa, in the South and here in the United States. We have a great, our mac and cheese kugel.
We don't boil our brisket.
With this mac and cheese kugel, which imagine kugel, you pushed it as far as you can into mac and cheese land while still being kugel, is inspired by one of Michael Twitty's recipes.
Michael Twitty.
Yeah.
Kosher soul, man.
Yeah. Exactly. And then, you know, we have all these great kind of what we call magical Jewish objects floating around, you know, which, you know, everything from a little ticket taker that, you know, has the Midrashic tradition that like that you should have these two verses in your pocket at all time. One that says, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, for my sake the world was created, and ani anochi afer ve'efer, I'm dust and ashes, and you should have them in each pocket so you can stay in balance. We have a little ticket taker so you can take one of each and keep it with you. We have like Jewish texts for every occasion, which are like these short Jewish texts for all sorts of random occasions, like you're you're drunk and thinking about texting your ex, or you're constipated, or you just graduated from college, or or you're trying to decide whether or not to go to the funeral. The answer is yes. All sorts of things.
Oh, that's incredible. I did a little homework on the place, and I love the Seder plate salad, which I don't know if that's on the menu at the moment right now, but
it just came off. You know, the Seder plate salad is great. It had like all elements of the Seder plate on it. We have roasted croutons and a horseradish dressing is great. It, you know, we try to stay seasonal with the holidays. You can only be celebrating Passover for so long. So we have a tuba av salad on now, which has this amazing grape vinaigrette and hearts of palm, because both hearts and white and so tuba, which is like kind of like a Jewish Valentine's Day. So
tuba's day of love, right?
Day of love, exactly. Yes. Exactly. So we try to integrate both like holidays and Jewish experience in both the cocktail menu and the food menu, which is wild, because there's like a long tradition of Jewish there's a long Jewish culinary tradition, right?
Of course.
But there's like less of a Jewish cocktail tradition. So
there isn't. Right?
So we're kind of making it up.
That's awesome.
So you'll see on our cocktail menu sometimes we do like a holiday. So we have an amazing drink called Day of Rest, which is basically a New York sour, but as if it's the entirety of a Shabbat dinner. So we wash the bourbon with challah. It's challah washed bourbon.
Challah washed bourbon.
Yeah, it gives it like a good like breadiness to it. Okay. We have amazing sourdough challah that we do in house, so we use that. We soak it in the bourbon, and then
what kind of bourbon? If we could break it down.
It's Four Roses.
Four Roses.
Okay. Yeah,
and that's a rye.
No, I think Four Roses is a bourbon. Yeah,
it's a corn.
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe I believe it's a bourbon. We can check when we go in. Okay. I don't want to get a whole bunch of like ats, you know, in terms of like
thinking about the grain connecting with the wheat and the challah.
Yeah.
We
use like a poultry blend spice, you know, to give it a little bit of herbaceousness, then some lemon, like lemon chicken. And then because it's a whiskey sour, a New York sour, it has a red wine float on top. So it's like the totality of a Shabbat dinner, you know, right there. But then we'll also do things that like reference different communities. So we have an amazing drink called the Colonia Roma, which is the Jewish neighborhood in Mexico City, one of the historically Jewish neighborhoods with a huge Syrian community. There's a lot of Syrian Jews in Mexico City. You know, they come from like both Aleppo and Damascus. They're both Halabi and from Damascus, and they don't get along. Like, you know, I'm sure they do now, but they used to not. And so it's an amazing drink that kind of ties those flavor profiles of Syria and Mexico together. So it has mezcal, that smokes of mezcal, tamarind, lime,
Aleppo
and apricot.
Pepper?
No Aleppo pepper in that one. We do use Aleppo pepper elsewhere. Okay.
I feel like Aleppo pepper is in tajin. It just feels like it.
Maybe, yeah, maybe, I don't know.
It's roasted pepper. But
yeah, yeah.
I don't know
yeah.
If it's Aleppo pepper.
Yeah, I guess it's more like chipotle and like, you know, like, and things like that. But I could be wrong. Yeah,
oh, man, that's so cool.
Yeah, so yeah, we tell like all sorts of Jewish stories in both the cocktail menu and the food menu, and like every step of the way that you come here, you know, you can either engage in the learning or you can just be like, this is an awesome place. I'm just going to spend some time here and hang out. So it's like this kind of amazing low barrier of entry, casual way to engage in the best of the Jewish world.
That's amazing. I mean, have you ever done like a class surrounding a drink or a dish?
Yeah.
Kind of led to that?
We've done a couple of things like that. We should probably do more. We've done some Passover drinks and we'll do classes around those. We did a great class on Kugel a while back, you know. So we do our learning offerings here are very varied, you know, everything from Talmud You Should Know to the Secret Jewish History of Punk and everything in between.
I didn't know that.
Oh, do you know about heebie-jeebies at CBGB's?
CBGB's. I've been there many times for punk shows before it closed.
There's this great book. This is not what this interview is about.
Okay.
There's a great book called The Heebie-Jeebies at CBGB's, which is all about the Jewish history and influence on the American punk scene. Yeah.
Okay. Well, of course, the Ramones, right?
when you break it down, like a lot of those like foundational acts were Jewish. Like Ramon's probably the most famous. Sure. But then you even get people like, you know, like they were all the children. Oh, I don't.
That's okay.
It's a different.
We can jump into it.
A lot of those guys were the kids of Holocaust survivors, or grew up in communities where there were a lot of Holocaust survivors. And so, you know, the thesis of this book, one of the theses is that a lot of that punk kind of spirit was pushing against, you know, the experience of growing it up in homes and communities like that. And you see them, like there is like the taking on of like certain iconography that like overlaps with, you know, kind of German World War II a way that is you know, pushing against the norms of their parents and their communities. Right. And like one of the anecdotes brings up is like Iggy Pop started doing that. Iggy Pop's not Jewish, and he got nailed for it because like he's like not, he didn't understand what he was doing. He's like, oh, these guys are doing this thing, I can do this thing. And he's like, and people are like, no, you're not, this is not for you. It's the heebie-jeebies at CBGBs. Oh, highly recommend it. Yeah.
Well, I have a quick connector story. I wonder if this has anything to do with why Iggy got smart. Iggy's girlfriend for a while and photographer was Esther Friedman.
Exactly. You know, so exactly. It was exactly that time period where this happened. Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So my Abba, that's his cousin.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So you're like Iggy Friedman Pop's like second cousin twice removed.
Yes. Former roommate.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome.
That's incredible. Wow. All right. So we're going to have another interview another time about Jewish punk.
No. The author of Heebie-Jeebies at CBGBs lives in Cambridge. You got to talk to him. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right. He's the guy.
You're the plug then.
He's the guy. Exactly. I'm happy to connect you.
Yeah. So also what's going on here is, you know, your professional connection and your love of technology, right? And media and how that plays a role in learning. You know, in this world now where we've got AI and algorithms and like the ever shrinking attention span, you know, your projects like Media Midrash, apps that you've made, right? You're clearly attempting to like get into that space and that sphere. My question, right, after all that setup, you know, how do you think Jewish learning and Jewish taverns need to keep evolving so that, you know, Torah still shapes the way people are and think about the future?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. Like one thing just to begin with. So my co-founder here is Josh Foyer, who also co-founded Sfaria, right? So like one of the, you know, biggest technological innovations in Jewish learning and its impact on the Jewish community, I think, is only now starting to be understood and probably won't be fully understood for another 100 years. We had a big fight when we opened Lair House, Josh and I.
Oh my gosh.
And it was, it's a breaking story. It was whether or not to have screens here. And I was like, you know,
TV screens,
any kinds of screens. He was like, we should have iPads everywhere. Like there should be like access to like all text digitally. We should have screens places, like displaying things. He was like a maximalist. He was like, we should have screens in the space.
Yeah.
And I was like, no screens anywhere.
And why? What was your?
Because like my take on this is like people have access to screens all the time if they want. Like people have access to Sfaria on their phones, right? Like it's not a hard thing to give someone access to things. It's much harder to give people access to spaces where that doesn't exist, right? Mm-hmm. So if we can create a space where there is a minimum of screens, because it's rare to be able to find a place where you can't access screens or where it's harder to access screen. We do not have a policy here where we're like you cannot use screens here. We're screen agnostic, but we try to minimize the screens that we have in the space to create a paradigm where the primacy is around in-person interaction. Right. All the time we get people asking, like, can you live stream your events? Like, you know, like we get this request so often because people see like what we're offering and they want to have it in their home. And our line is always no. It's like there are lots of great places to do online Jewish learning. And there's great places that excel at Zoom classes and amazing things like that.
For sure.
And that even that blended, you know, in-person things that are streamed are. Our value proposition here is actually about the in-person connection, right? So it's about being here. It's about being in the space. It's about meeting people. And so even with like my background in educational technology, which is something I still love to pursue, it was more about, and I think I mostly won the fight with Josh, not 100%. But it's really about the about how can you limit access to technology in a way that pushes people towards in-person encounters. To the extent where, like, when we first opened, we run like 2 to 3 classes a night here, and we didn't have a screen for teachers to present on.
Oh, wow.
Because I was like, no screens. Wow. And I backed off from that because, like, most people have slides and they want to be able to show, you know, if we're doing art things, we want to be able to show, slides and things like that. So we do now have that. But at the beginning, I was like, no, it's really about, if you want to show something, print it on a piece of paper so that people don't feel that there's like a, you know, you're not like mitigating that encounter with someone. Because the truth is, like, the minute you set up a projector and show it on a screen, the interactions that people have.
Didactic, right?
Exactly. Like the point of focus goes from, it becomes much harder to have like a conversation around the table because everyone is focused on that bright object on the screen as opposed to the bright internal object across the table from them is another person.
Right, the much more sophisticated machine.
Yeah. Ideally. Yeah.
Oh man, wow. I mean, so what was Josh's like? Kind of, it sounded like he was like okay, and then y'all kind of saw what was what.
Yeah, he wasn't okay. He agreed with me ultimately.
Made a good argument.
Yeah. It's a good It's a good argument for the sake of heaven.
Amen.
So,
yeah. Well, I appreciate that there's that mixture because you're right. Like, people will bring that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, we don't even build computer labs at our colleges anymore because kids bring better computers than we can ever afford.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To do amazing things. You mentioned that Josh, your co-founder, helped start Safaria, right? Which is a mainstay in so many folks' lives now. I've actually read some of your sheets on there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
I did. I mean, it's like, you know, you don't check somebody out. You check their LinkedIn, their Facebook, their X, and their Safari sheets.
Which I'm curious if there were any good ones that you found.
I had some favorites.
Yeah.
I really loved mezuzah hacking.
Oh, that was fun. That was a fun. Yeah.
So helpful.
Yeah.
Because I was working on a project at the time to make a mezuzah. And I was like, all right, where do you find, like, how do you Google, like, the halakha, right? And the minhagim of, like, mezuzah making? So you don't do it wrong.
Yeah.
And yours was helpful to have those verses there as well as your thoughts.
Yeah. That was a fun one. That came about because. And so I do a lot of educational technology work with my good friend, Russell Neese. And he was teaching a class one summer at Brandeis, where I worked. And they were trying to hack Jewish ritual objects. And he had a student come up with a mezuzah where when you kissed it, it sent you a text message of the Shema. And so like that kind of like, so then we started, we actually developed a workshop where we could use like little, they're called little bits. They were like little modular sensors and things like that. And we're like, okay, so like, what kind of mezuzah could you make with that? So that's where that source sheet came from. It was a fun project.
I love that. And you know, it's stuff like that, honestly, that like, and this is how things work. Like, I found that that sheet long ago. I never thought, let me find out who this guy is.
And then
I was like, wait a minute. Because I started searching for you and it came back up. I was like, I've been here before.
Yeah.
This is that guy.
Yeah.
I also loved your design thinking, the text selections.
Yeah.
The stuff on rabbinic creativity, and then of course your authenticity and Jewish ed.
Yeah. Those you know, it's funny because like those are each kind of like moments from from various points of my career. I used to do a lot around design thinking. I ran a design lab at Brandeis where we taught like a modified approach to design thinking to high school students, then had them apply it to a real world challenge facing a local Jewish organization.
And we're talking about like IDEO and Stanford's.
Exactly. But we kind of like created like a more simplified version. And so we did some great builds. One year we partnered with a cemetery and had them. We remodeled one of their chapel spaces to be an educational space. And like to bring high school students to a cemetery, like a historic Jewish cemetery, like every Sunday, like week after week, and do like empathy work around like the people who work at the cemetery, the people who are visiting the cemetery, like what's needed.
Stuff.
Yeah, it was like it was phenomenal. So that was one great build that we did. We did another really good build with Hebrew Senior Life, where in their assisted living facility, they were holding Shabbat services in like a large communal space. They wanted it to feel more like a synagogue, right?
Yeah.
And so to do the empathy work around like, hey, what are the things that make a space feel like a synagogue with a bunch of high school students, and having them interview the residents, you know, of this facility and the staff, and like to go to synagogues and like what's the smell of a synagogue? What, and like, when, you know, we did a lot of super fun things in that space. One of the things that I think was the most interesting was an acknowledgement of like what a threshold moment is.
Oh,
and the residents really wanted like a tallest rack and a bookcase, right? Huh. So that, because like for them, when you enter the space,
yeah, the sitter,
yeah, you want like where the sitterim are, and you want a place where the tallest is hung, and that signifies that you're entering a synagogue. So like so like even more than a mezuzah, right? It was like to have a threshold moment that reminds them more of a synagogue, and that was like a super easy fix, like to get a bunch of high school students to build like a tallest rack and a bookcase. That was simple. There were more complicated things, but it was one of those like great kind of empathy learning moments.
And that like that completely set the tone, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, not, you know, not every time for every person, but like, you know, as like, as a reminder about like, how do we craft experiences and like, what are the physical, markers of a space or an experience?
Right. And that's heuristics, right? That's like gestalt. That's all the things. And
one thing we did not, this is a very fun build. Yeah. One thing we did not execute well, which I wish we had, is we went to a few synagogues, and every time we had the kids, the students close their eyes and smell, right?
No.
No, it was good. Because like, what does it smell like? And like the thing that kind of the thing that kind of came up, you know, over and over again was like the smell of spilled wine on felt. Like that was like a marked thing that like, you know, and I think if we're being honest, it's like spilled wine and melted wax on like that kind of like that really worn felt bima. And like, so I wanted to like put felt on a bima, spill wine on it and melt wax on it, but we never quite got to that level of fidelity to the synagogue experience.
Wow. Yeah. I sort of imagine y'all getting like a essential oil kit with tobacco and building out
we should do that. We should sell synagogue scent. I think that's a good idea. I think that would sell very well for very few people.
Yeah, indeed. Oh man. I don't know. It'd be like warning, not nostalgic, right?
Yeah, not triggering. Yeah. Did you grow up going to synagogue or no?
Yeah. I grew up in Long Island, and also Queens. So floated between. I had Sephardi family, step family, and then Ashkenazi. So kind of bounced between those worlds. Yeah.
So did you have like memories of like Havdalah with like fresh herbs?
Yeah. But only at the Sephardic.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah, they were the Havdalah followers, you know.
Like, yeah.
That was a little bit too much for the Ashkenazi side. And I appreciate that because I think like there's so much more somatic practice out there, you know, that like I love how it connects to the drinks and like even the Lairhouse itself has an aroma, a smell to it. When I walked in, it wasn't just coffee and sandwiches. It smelled like a little bit of like a yeshiva, you know, the glue in the books is present.
Yeah. It's you know, I think we could have a little bit more of that, like, you know, fresh baked bread smell coming in, but it does evoke, I think the right kind of memories for a lot of people. But yeah, but it's interesting, like thinking about the signifiers of synagogue, because one of the things that we wanted to do at Lairhouse was to create a Jewish space that's more accessible than synagogues. Because like at the end of the day, like you need to know a lot to enter a synagogue, right? You need to know where to sit, what time to be there, you know, how to get in, you know, what book to get at what time. And that changes based on the day. You know, it's actually like you need like a lot of Jewish knowledge just to even enter the space.
Sure. Most people are intimidated.
Yeah. I mean, like I I remember I went to one of my synagogues, and I went to like a minyan to a service I don't usually go to. I sat down in a seat, and someone was like, "You can't sit there." And I'm like, "This is my synagogue." Yeah,
like, who are you?
Yeah. But like with a restaurant, you know, if you are from the society, the broader society or milieu, or the cultural milieu that the restaurant's in, like, you know roughly the rules, right? Like, you walk in a restaurant and you know, like, a host will greet you. They'll sit you down if there's space. They'll ask you to wait if there's not. You can sit at that table for a good amount of time. People will bring you food, right? There's like an expectation of like hospitality and service that you get, right? And so like the ability to enter like a restaurant space is just like radically different than a synagogue space. And so like one of the secrets here is that like we're not just building Jewish community. We're building Jewish community through exceptional hospitality, right? And like hospitality is something that people understand, they get it, they respond to it in such positive ways when it's done well. And yeah, it's like to see the power of those things intersecting of a real serious professional approach to hospitality and what it means to build Jewish community through the lens of Jewish learning. It's like it's magical.
It is. And I think, you know, you've really captured the third space phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
That, like, we talk about in societal life, right? It's like, for some people, that's the pub or CBGBs, you know, and whatnot. And yeah, like, it's awesome because now you've made that third space Jewish.
Yeah.
And Jewish in a way that anybody can access it, right?
Yeah.
Like, and you meet people at the door, right, with the Torah, so to speak, right?
Yeah. We, you know, we're working on expanding to multiple cities, with DC being the first one. And so we're in real life here.
We are live.
So we were interviewing architects to help us with the design phase of Lair House DC. And it was phenomenal because we described what we were doing, and every architect we talked to was like, "Oh my God, that's a third place." Cause they learn about these places in architecture school.
Yeah.
And like, and there's a common understanding that they're decreasing in society. So to have the opportunity to design like a true third place is so exciting for them. So it was fun. Like, we actually like could really, really choose which architect we want to work with, because like they were so excited by the project.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have such unique programming. You know, I sit in on our interior design and architecture reviews every year. Our seniors present. So I hear all about how they do the analysis of the space. And I could see, yes, this would be such an exciting place.
Yeah.
Because there's so much creativity that could go into, and it's, you know, the sky's the limit. The slate is clean.
Yeah. Yeah. The budget is the limit. But
But that's so exciting to hear about Lair House DC, that there'll be one just, you know, like 10 hours closer drive than the current Lair House to me in the South. So that's exciting. But, you know, let me push your brain a little bit further. You know, we'll let the Boston responders do their thing here. Appreciate them. But when you're thinking about, you know, Lair House, let's jump like 30 years into the future.
Yeah. Right?
So practically, sounds like expansion is a good way to grow the business and whatnot. Talk about the impact societally, culturally of Lair House. What do you want there?
Yeah. So I would say like kind of two or three main areas. One is, you know, we said this when even before we're open, when people say, "What makes me Jewish?" we want them to respond, "I learn." We want learning to be an essential part of what it means to be Jewish. If you look at the Pew study, there's nothing about Jewish learning as an essential Jewish practice. If you look at, you know, the way Birthright tracks Jewish engagement, I don't believe there's anything about learning, right? And yet this is, I don't believe so. I think there's a lot of around ritual practice and endogamy, but like less about learning. So we want to make learning an essential marker of Jewish identity, right? And the way we want to do that is by creating environments where learning can thrive. So I'd say that's one. Two, the impact of a vibrant third place like Lair House is that one, it makes people excited about Judaism, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish, in a way that has positive impacts for the Jewish community. And two, it creates thicker social bonds within a community that makes that community resilient to stress or, you know, whatever might be coming. So to live in a world where Judaism, one way people define what it means to be Jewish is through learning. That's part of it. a world where people have access to the best of a joyous Jewish life, and that's Jews and non-Jews, so they can understand the totality of Jewish experience, which right now it's hard to get. And then third is like the social, thicker, more robust bonds within a community that a place like this creates through the experiences we're able to have here.
Love that. So paint us a picture. Like, what would a futuristic Lair House maybe look like, or somebody who's a regular at Lair House who then brings Lair House home and into their other Jewish spaces?
Yeah. So let's say it's like someone like, a Jewish person who wanders in off the street because they saw what was going on here. They heard that there were great cocktails. They have a cocktail. They hear about the secret, Jewish history of punk class that's coming up. They take it. They're like, well, I didn't know the Jewish community was so wild, maybe they sign up to do one-on-one learning with, one of our learning guides. And then they transform that into like a regular habit of learning, and they increase their connection to the Jewish community and the Jewish world through that lens. We had someone in recently who was brought up in, for me, this story is a great arc of what a place like this can do.
Perfect. Yeah.
She grew up in an interfaith household, but her mother was Jewish, but kind of not super, super engaged. She started coming here to Lair House to do learning because we opened up like 2 minutes from her house.
Nice.
She because of those experiences or through those experiences, she started going to a local synagogue. The rabbi encouraged her to do like more learning at Hebrew College. So she did that. And then she realized that she was born Jewish, brought up Jewish, but she wanted to do like an affirmation of like Jewish faith. And so she went to Mayim Chaim, which is our local pluralistic mikvah, and immersed in the mikvah, then came back here to celebrate that, that experience. So the idea of and we sent her a bottle of champagne because when you become Jewish, you should, reaffirm your Judaism. Yeah. You should have some champagne. So the idea that there's such a low barrier of entry to start learning, and this to be an on-ramp to a deeper engagement in the Jewish world. For me, that's one amazing kind of path of engagement of Lair House. You also have people who maybe are already super engaged in Jewish life and learning, but maybe their colleagues have never experienced, their colleagues at work have never experienced what Jewish life can be. So bringing their colleagues here for dinner where that makes sense. That's something you could do and be here's the amazingness of Judaism in a way that you can access through a lens that, that you get, that's another, arc that, that we're always excited about. There's a few more, but those are, demonstrative.
That's amazing. So it sounds like we're going to keep doing Lair House until we don't need to anymore. Right?
You always need great places to gather. Absolutely. So we're not solving a problem that goes away, right? The problem of how as people do we create meaningful connections? Mm. How do we have moments of important impact? How do we access learning? Those are all things that are always going to be important. Restaurants aren't going anywhere, right? No. Gathering places are not going anywhere. I don't think synagogues are going anywhere, right? So, and the need that Lair House fills, we do solve a problem and we are addressing a need, but that need is not going to disappear.
No, I think, you guys do such an excellent job of really creating this cultural way in, right? We are in the West, and most people, if they're not Jewish, think of themselves as having a ethnicity, a culture, and then religion on top of that, right? In whatever country they live in, that's their nationality. Ours, we're ethno-religious, so ours fuse, right?
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about that. Right?
Yeah, when we were first opening, we got a fair amount of press just because what we're doing is kind of weird. Yeah.
anybody upset or say,
no, no one was upset. But I would do these interviews with a lot of local media and they would say, oh, so this is a religious place.
Right. Right.
And I would always be like, no. And they're like, well, what is it? I see you have religious texts, you're a rabbi, this is obviously a religious place.
Yeah, what gives?
Yeah, and I'd be like, that's a real kind of Protestant way to think about Judaism, right? And, you know, as you say, like, we are, a religion is part of what we do, right? And part of what we are. And that's part of the story that goes on here at Lair House, but it's not the totality, right? That we are very much a people that includes a religion, but also includes shared language, shared history, you know, shared, you know, calendar, like all the things that go into what it means to be a people. So we think hard about what it means to be not just a religious place, also because most Jews aren't religious. if we want to be able to access and impact like the largest swath of the Jewish community possible, you know, thinking about what are the ways that people connect to the Jewish people is very important.
Man, that's super, super cool. So, I mean, this seems like such a lab for new Judaism. And, you know, super excited tonight to have this class. You know, I'm going to be talking about, because I do user experience. That's what I teach at the university that I work at. And bringing a lot of the design thinking stuff we were talking about earlier in terms of ritual design, right? And being cognizant of your users and whatnot and studying the impact. Is there anything, Charlie, that you've shared a little bit of some fun things in the future that are exciting, but is there anything that's like coming up that you haven't released yet or that you can share with us now?
Things that are coming up that are exciting. I mean, we're excited to just grow our impact here in Boston and to bring Lair House to as many communities as we can in the future. We think it's like something that's desperately needed in the Jewish world and going to be an integral part of the Jewish landscape moving forward. So, in addition to, you know, my hypothetical dream of having Amba soft serve being on the menu, which if you don't know Amba, it's like a delicious pickled mango chutney dish that Iraqi Jews kind of brought back from India.
Good. Yes.
My team keeps saying that Amba soft serve is not a good idea, but
you gotta just try it.
A rabbi can dream, right?
That's right.
So other than that, just it's really, really growing our impact, finding ways to expand. We do very little around Shabbat right now because it's just hard with kashrut, but like thinking about, okay, so what does the best Shabbat experience at Lair House look like? What is a really amazing Shabbat dinner at Lair House? What can that be? Expanding into areas like that, and then just like bringing Lair House, not just to Boston, but to cities around the country.
Yeah. Love that. Well, Rabbi Charlie, this has been absolutely incredible. Thanks for doing this live.
It's amazing having you in the backyard. Thanks so much for being here, and good luck on your class tonight.
Thank you so much, friend.
Yeah. All right. Until next time.
Yes.
You have been listening to the Jewish Futurism Lab, a weekly independent production of Mike Wirth Art Incorporated. If you are into these conversations, make sure you follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And drop a rating and a review so more folks can find the show. And to go deeper, hit up MikeWirthArt.com, MikeWirthArt.com, for more episodes, merch, original art, and essays. That is MikeWirthArt.com. And come hang with me on Instagram. I'm at MikeWirth. MikeWirth. And if you are or know somebody who is a fascinating Jewish futurist who should be on this microphone with me here, slide into my DMs and tell me who I should talk to next. Until next time, friends, see you in the future.